We're going to talk about a topic that is simply using a biblical phrase tonight, a door of hope. But the story we're going to be looking at begins in the book of Joshua. And it is a famous and very well-known story. It actually begins a long time before Joshua chapter 6, when God told Abraham that your descendants will be enslaved in a foreign land for 200 years, and then I will bring them out with a mighty hand. Well, the time finally arrived for that to happen. God's people had wound up in Egypt, and God said, I'm bringing you out of there. And so God sent Moses, brought Israel out of Egypt, brought them to Mount Sinai. There he gave them his law and said, you've been around this mountain long enough, let's go to the land of Canaan. And so they journeyed for 11 days up to Kadesh Barnea, and there they sent spies into the land. And you recall that they had a stumbling moment there where the spy said, there's no way we could take this land. The people are strong. They have walled cities there. There's no way we could ever take this. And so God said, okay, if you don't want to live in my land, then you just turn yourself around and march back into the wilderness. You will die there, God told them, and your children will get in. And so that's exactly what happened. It took 40 years. There was a 40-year interruption in the fulfillment of God's promise. It was supposed to be immediate, but because of their lack of faith, the Israelites did not get to go in. But finally, when we get to the book of Joshua, Israel has entered into the land of Canaan. That's the first couple chapters. And so they crossed the Jordan River. They camped in a place called Gilgal, which is near Jericho. And the first city that they came to was Jericho. Jericho sits at a strategic point by the Jordan River. It guards the pass from Transjordan into the land of Canaan. The people who lived in Canaan realized that this is the way that people would come into our land, so they put a city there, a walled city, a fortified city, to protect their land. And so the Israelites came to Jericho. And it is a fascinating story. You remember what God told them. He said, here's what you're going to do. Every day, you're going to get up and you're going to march around the city one time and blow the trumpets. You're going to do that for 6 days. On the seventh day, you're going to march around the city seven times, going to blow the trumpets and shout, and when you do that, the walls will fall down and you can take the city. And I'm quite sure that the people who heard that said, that's interesting, because that is not the way you take a city in the ancient world. In the ancient world, if you want to conquer a fortified city, you have to blockade it, get your army around it, and cut off all the food supplies, keep messengers from going in or out. And while you've got the city blockaded, you're out there making bows and arrows and catapults and all kinds of war engines and machinery. And while you're doing that, the people inside the city are eating up all the food they've got. And it may take a while. If they know that you are coming, they may have stored up food. It could take up to a year, sometimes a year and a half, before they run out of food. But eventually the day will come when they run out of food. And when they run out of food, then you just wait. You wait about a month until the people inside the city are so weak that they cannot pick up a spear or a sword, and then you attack the city. March around a city six times, blow horns, and the walls will fall down. Nobody's ever heard of that method. But God said, yes, this is the way it's going to work. No need, we're not going to take a year and a half to conquer every city you come to. You do it this way and the walls will fall down. And to their credit, this generation of the Israelites did exactly what God told them to do. And just like God said, the walls of the city fell down flat. The people went straight ahead into the city, and they were able to capture the city and take it. These people learned something that a lot of people in this old world still need to learn. And that is that if we trust God and if we obey His instructions, God will be with us. That things will work if we do them God's way. God's way works. All we have to do is trust in it. And trust in the God who gave it to us, and things will work out exactly the way God said they would. So they entered the land, they conquered the city of Jericho, and they were able now to get into the interior of the land. But you realize that conquering the city of Jericho was not the goal. Getting into the land, into the center of the land, was not the goal. The overall goal of what they were doing is to live with God. We talked a little bit about this in one of our lessons yesterday, for those of you who were with us, but that's always the goal, for God's people to be with God in God's place. And God said in Deuteronomy chapter 12 and verse 5, that you will go into the land to the place where I will cause my name to dwell. That place turns out to be Jerusalem. And that's the point of everything they were doing. God says, I'm going to have my place on my mountain in Jerusalem, and you're going to build a city there, and my house will be there, your houses will be there. We're going to live together in the land, and my people will be with me. That was the goal of everything. And so that's the context as we come here to Joshua chapter 6. But there's other things that we need to think of as background information before we move any farther. There is this thing in the Old Testament, and the term I'm using for it tonight is simply the law of firsts. It's not called that in the Bible, but that's what I'm going to call it tonight. It is simply the law that we read about in Exodus chapter 13, where the firstborn of everything belonged to God, whether it was a firstborn animal or whether it was a firstborn child. In the case of an animal, it had to be sacrificed to God. In the case of a child, it had to be redeemed. And you would take that child to the temple and you would pay God the redemption money for your child. There's a similar law in Exodus 23 that's repeated in Exodus 24, and that is the first of the crops. Every year when the crops began to get ripe, that's called the first fruits of the crops. And God said in Exodus 23 and 34 that those are mine. And God was simply teaching Israel a very important lesson that God comes first. Whatever it is that you have, whatever it is that you do, God comes first. He gets the first of everything. And in a similar way, the first city of Canaan would belong to God. Just like those firstborn people or animals or the first fruits of the crops, the first city of the conquest would be God's. In Joshua chapter 6 and in verse 17, God says, the city shall be under the ban. And the ban simply means that you can't have any of it. That none of the loot in that city may be for you. Now, normally in the ancient world, that's exactly what you would do. You would destroy a city and you would take its loot. As a matter of fact, that's how soldiers got paid in the ancient world, that you would loot the places that you destroyed. But God said, no, the loot from Jericho belongs to me. And so these things are under the ban. You may not covet them. You may not take some of the things under the ban and make the camp of Israel accursed by bringing trouble on it. All the silver and gold and articles of bronze and iron are holy to the Lord. They shall go into the treasury of the Lord. So the loot from Jericho was God's. And so, okay, they proceeded. They marched around the city like God told them to. The walls, as we noted, fell flat, and the city was taken. Well, in chapter 7 of the book of Joshua, they came to this place, and there is a debate about whether it is pronounced Ai or I, and I'm going to pronounce it as I, and if you don't like that, you can talk to me about that later and correct me, but I'm going to say that for the sermon tonight, that they came to the place called Ai. Some biblical scholars think it is the place that you see on the screen here, a place that is simply known as Etel in modern Palestine. There is another place right next to this that some scholars say is the place, so we don't really know exactly where this city was, but it was somewhere in this area. But regardless of the exact location of the city, we're told in Joshua chapter 7 and verse 2 that Joshua sent men from Jericho to Ai, which is near Beth-Aven, east of Bethel, and said, go up and spy out the land. So the men went up and spied out the city of Ai. And they returned to Joshua, and they said to him, don't let all the people go up. Only about 2,000 or 3,000 men need to go up to Ai. Do not make all the people toil up there, for they, that is the people of that city, are few. So in other words, yeah, Joshua, we have done the reconnaissance, and this is not a big city. There is no need to send the whole army up there. And to their credit, they are still believing in God. They have learned the lesson from Jericho that if we do what God tells us to do and if we act in faith, that God will be with us. And so we're going to count on God being with us. And we're not going to act as if it takes all of the army of Israel to go up there. We're just going to send a small force. God will be with them and the city will fall. And that was a perfectly good plan. Perfectly good plan. And so about 3,000 men from the people went up there, but the text says they fled from the people or the men of Ai. They couldn't take the city. And I'm sure that these people were thinking, what in the world has gone wrong here? Well, why doesn't this work? It worked last week when we were at Jericho and God said he would be with us, and here we are acting in faith. And now the soldiers were repulsed. And it didn't take these people very long to connect the dots. They said, you know what? There's really only one thing that this means, and that is that God is not with us. Because 3,000 men should be enough to conquer this little place. And if we can't do it, it means that God's not with us. Now, why would God not be with us? And again, to their credit, nobody says, well, maybe God doesn't want to, or maybe God can't, or maybe God's been unfaithful. No, they understand immediately that there must be disobedience. Somebody has done something. And so, in verse 6, Joshua tore his clothes and fell to the earth before the ark of the Lord until the evening, both he and the elders of Israel, and they put dust on their heads. And Joshua says, God, why did you bring us here only to deliver us into the hand of the Amorites? And if only we had been willing to dwell beyond the Jordan. What can I say since Israel has turned their back before their enemies? Why is this going on? He says, not only that, Lord, that all these other cities around here, they know we're invading the land, and all the other cities are going to hear about it. They'll surround us, cut off our name from the earth. And that's going to be the end of us. Why are you not with us? And God says to Joshua in verse 10, Joshua, stop your crying. Get up. Why are you falling on your face? Why are you acting like you don't understand anything? Israel has sinned. It's obvious that's why I can't do this for you. It's obvious why I'm not going to be with you, because you've not done what I told you to do. They have transgressed my covenant, which I have commanded them. They've taken some of the things under the ban, and they have stolen, and they have deceived. That's the problem, Joshua. And of course, I think Joshua understood immediately the ramifications of this. You hear it in his words there. Joshua understood immediately that this is the crossroads. That if we cannot take this small little city, if God is not going to be with us, then it's all over. I mean, this is as far as we're ever going to get. There's not going to be any conquest of Canaan. There's not going to be living in the land of milk and honey. God is not going to bless the fruit of our labors and make our crops grow. We're not going to build a city for God. None of that is going to happen if things are not right with God. If God is not with us, none of this is going to work. And again, you have to give Joshua credit. He understands how things work. He understands exactly the way things have to be. And I want you to think for a moment this evening at what a crucial moment this was in Israel's history. The entire future of Israel was at stake. You know, God had promised to Abraham that kings will come from you. Are they going to live in the land and kings are going to, are they going to have a kingdom? Are they going to conquer all this land and put all these other people under subjugation? Are they going to be the rulers of this part of God's world, or are they going to be repulsed by the enemy? And like Joshua said, all the other cities are going to hear about it. They're going to know that we are sitting ducks. They're going to come down here with their armies and they're going to kill us all. Joshua understood that the entire future of Israel was at stake. Well, God had told Joshua, Israel has sinned. Therefore, the sons of Israel cannot stand before their enemies. That's why they turn their backs before their enemies, because they have become accursed. And I will not be with you anymore unless you destroy the things that are under the ban in your midst. And so here's what I want you to do. I want you to come near by tribes in the morning, verse 14, and we're going to have this process that God says we're going to go through, and you're going to find out who did this. And so you recall that Joshua, in verse 16, got up early in the morning. He goes through the procedure that God gave him. They take the tribe of Judah. Then he brought the family of Judah near and the family of the Zerahites. And then man by man, Zabdi was taken. And then his household, man by man, until we came to Achan, son of Carmi, son of Zabdi, son of Zerah, from the tribe of Judah. And now Joshua knows who's done it. We're told at the beginning of the chapter, in good storytelling fashion, Joshua says, now I'm going to tell you something that I didn't know at the moment. But the sons of Israel had acted unfaithfully in regard to the things under the ban. For Achan, the son of Carmi, son of Zabdi, son of Zerah, from the tribe of Judah, took some of the things under the ban. And that's why God was angry. And so now we get to watch Joshua find out what we as the readers have already known, that Achan has stolen loot from Jericho. And so as we noted here, the inquiry was made, Achan and his family was discovered. And the text is really interesting at this point. Joshua says to Achan in verse 19, my son, I implore you, give glory to the Lord, the God of Israel, and give praise to him. Tell me what you've done. Do not hide it from me. And Achan said, truly, I've sinned against the Lord, the God of Israel, and this is what I did. When I saw among the spoil a beautiful mantle from Shinar and 200 shekels of silver and a bar of gold, 50 shekels in weight, I coveted them and took them. And behold, they are in the earth inside my tent with the silver underneath it. And I want you to listen to what Achan says. That I saw, I coveted, and I took. Does that ring a bell? Is there any other Bible story where that rings true? Yes. Genesis chapter 3. That Eve saw the fruit, that it was good to the eyes, beautiful in other words, and she took it and she ate it. The very vocabulary that is used in Genesis chapter 3 is used of Achan. He is walking in the footsteps of Adam and Eve. That's how sin happens. It's really not that complicated. That he saw, he coveted, and he took. And so Achan has admitted it. Joshua sent messengers. They looked inside the tent, and it was exactly the way Achan said. And so it says, they took them from inside the tent and brought them to Joshua. They poured all the loot out before the Lord, And Joshua and all Israel with him took Achan the son of Zerah. They took the silver, the mantle, the bar of gold, his sons, his daughters, his oxen, his donkeys, his sheep, his tent, his dogs, his cats, everything that belonged to him, and they brought them up to the valley of Achor. And Achan and all that he had was put to death. Joshua says to him, "Why have you troubled us? The Lord will trouble you this day." And all Israel stoned them with stones. And they burned them with fire after they had stoned them with stones. I just want to make a side point here, and then we'll move on with the lesson. Brethren, can you see how important it is that when it comes time to do the unpleasant business of church building, that of church discipline, that everybody has to be involved in it, that everybody has to participate, everybody has to cooperate. It doesn't work if only half the church participates. In the other half of the church acts like, "Well, I'm not going to disregard brother or sister so-and-so." It takes the entire group. And God here wanted Israel to all participate in it. All Israel stoned them with stones. Why? Because God wanted them to show them that they repudiated this action, that I do not agree with this, that I am not going to give my consent to what Achan did. And that's the way it's supposed to be, that we take our stand for righteousness. But Achan was executed. And it's a horrible story in the Bible with a horrible ending. It's so unpleasant, so difficult. It's one of those stories that when you read it, you think, "Oh, tell me that this didn't happen." But it did. And after he is executed, Israel is able to resume their progress, take up the fight once again, and pursue its life in the Promised Land. And the story ends this way, that they raised over him a great heap of stones that stands to this day, Joshua said. I've often thought, wouldn't that have been interesting if you lived back in that time? You could go to the Valley of Achor, and there's that big pile of stones. And if your children said, why are all those stones there? You could say, "Well, let me tell you what happened here." They executed Achan, and the Lord turned from the fierceness of his anger. And that's why they call this place Achor, Joshua said, because the Hebrew word Achor means trouble. Israel had a trouble here. Now this is where all of this has something to do with us. Because you see, like Achan, all of us have acted against God's commands. And it's kind of interesting. You remember how when Adam and Eve sinned and God confronted them that they had to fess up? Well, Achan does that very thing. Achan doesn't say, "Well, it wasn't clear to me if we could take it or not, or I just thought I would take it and then give it to God." No, Achan says, "I knew exactly what the rule was, and I just broke it." All of us have acted against God's command in exactly that way. All of us at some point in our life have rebelled and we have said, "I'm going to do what I know is not right." And we've done it for the same reasons. Like Achan, we act out of covetousness, that I want that thing looks good to me, that appeals to me, that would be fun, that would be pleasurable, and I'm going to do it, and I don't care what God said about it, I want this for me. And when we think like that, we step away from God. We rob God of the commitment that is due to Him. We take those things that should not be ours and make them ours. And like Achan, we put our journey to God on hold. And we place our entire future at risk. We're living in a world where nobody believes that anymore, sadly, that sin places your future at risk. In our world today, sin is no big deal. Sin, as a matter of fact, is dropping out of the English vocabulary. Sin is one of those words you're only going to hear in a church building, but we've stopped using that word in everyday conversation in our country. Why? Because we don't believe it anymore. Most people in this country don't believe that there is such a thing as sin, or if there is such a thing as sin, it's only something that people who go to church are concerned about. It's not a big deal, and my life can be just as good with or without it. But the Bible says no. You do this, then your journey to God stops. And whether or not it will ever continue is up to us. And this is where we come now to the book of Hosea. In Hosea chapter 2, you remember the situation in the time of Hosea that God uses the prophet and his wife as an illustration of the relationship between God and Israel. Just like Hosea's wife is unfaithful, God says, now you know what I'm going through, that my people have been unfaithful to me. And you remember back there in chapter 1 that Hosea's wife has a child, and God says, you should call that child not my people, not mine. You ever thought about that? What are we going to name the baby? Well, if I were you, I'd call it not mine. How devastated Hosea must have been. And God says, that's the way it is, isn't it? This is not my people. And so God is chastising Israel in the book of Hosea. But in chapter 2 and verse 14, after God has talked about punishing her, God had said, for example, in chapter 2 and verse 10, I'm going to uncover her lewdness in the sight of her lovers. No one will rescue her out of my hand. I'll put an end to all of her gaiety, her feasts, her new moon Sabbaths, and her festal assemblies. I'll destroy her vines and fig trees, of which she said, these are my wages, which my lovers have given me. Verse 13, I will punish her for the days of the Baals. But the good news of the book of Hosea is that God would not be that way forever. And so in verse 14, God said, the time will come when I will allure her, and I will bring her into the wilderness and speak kindly to her. I want you to listen to what God is saying there. I will bring her into the wilderness. And if you say wilderness in a Jewish context, the first thing that always comes to mind is the Exodus. And God is saying, we're going to do this again. We're going to have another Exodus, as it were. That my people have been estranged from me again, but just like they were in Egypt, I'm going to bring them back to me. We're going to have another Exodus. We're going to go back to the wilderness. We're going to start all over again. I'm going to speak kindly to her. I will no longer be chastising her and rebuking her and threatening her with punishment. We're going to start over, and I will speak kindly to her. And I'll give her her vineyards, the ones that I promised to destroy up in verse 12. God says, we're going to redo all of that. We're going to start over again. And then a surprising statement. That I will give her the Valley of Achor as a door of hope. And I'm sure that the Israelites who knew their history heard that and said, wait a minute, I know that story. The Valley of Achor is where Achan sinned and where they had to execute this sinner, and Israel was troubled that day. And God, you're saying we're going to have to go through that again? How in the world will this be hope for us? Well, you probably have figured it out already that this is ultimately a description of what you and I have enjoyed in the gospel. You see, at Achor, a man died for sin. And he died so that the progress of God's people could continue, so that they could go on and resume their journey and ultimately live with God in God's place. And in his own strange way, Achan is a type of Jesus. But unlike Achan, Jesus does not die for his sins. Jesus dies for the sins of others because Jesus is sinless. And so now with hindsight, we can look back and we see, I see what you're saying there, God. Bringing us to the Valley of Achor means that God has brought us back to a place of death. He has brought us to the Valley of Achor in the death of Jesus Christ. And if you thought that the story of Achor was a terrible story with a terrible ending, then read the story of the life of Jesus. How he came to this earth, and as John the Apostle says, that he came to his own and his own did not receive him. That his own did not even recognize him as the Messiah. They thought that he was a blasphemer and a troublemaker, and they executed him and they used the Romans to do it. So twisted, so backwards was their thinking that when their king that Isaiah had promised was standing right in front of them, they didn't even see it. And they put him to death. And it is the greatest tragedy in the history of the world, no doubt. And yet, you and I know that that tragic event turns out to be the very thing that will make everything right. That tragic story holds the key to reconciliation with God. For Jesus dies for sin, the just for the unjust, as Peter would say. And if we will join ourselves to him, there is hope. And so the Valley of Achor is where God brings us. To bring us to that suffering, to bring us to that dying, because through that dying there is life, and through that tragedy there is hope. You remember how it said back there in the book of Joshua that they raised a great heap of stones over Achan, and it is there unto this day? Well, God has given us a memorial of this death as well. A memorial of the benefit that it has produced for us, and every Lord's Day we participate in that memorial, the Lord's Supper, that it too stands until this day. But here's where we will end the lesson. God brings us to the Valley of Achor, not just to watch another man die, but to die with him. That's the New Testament story of redemption. That's the New Testament picture of propitiation, of justification. You see, the Bible is saying not that just Jesus died for us, period. I think it is a horrible disservice in modern denominational religion that that doctrine gets taught. That Jesus died for me, he substituted himself for me, and so I'm off the hook. Whoa. That's not how it works. Jesus just died for me and now I'm off the hook. No, God says you must join Jesus. Romans chapter 6, we were baptized into his death. We were buried with him into death. Four or five times in Romans chapter 6, Paul uses that phrase, with him, with him, with him, with him. And the death of Jesus is not just for me, it is for me to copy. It is for me to participate in. And ultimately, the life that God wants for my sin is mine, given to him after the manner of Jesus. God calls us to the Valley of Achor, not to just watch Jesus die, but to participate in his dying. Each of us must die to the flesh. Each of us must die to sin after the manner of Jesus Christ. And when that happens, then our journey to God may resume. And so there lies the question of the evening for every one of us. Where am I at on this journey? If you've never begun this journey, and you need to become a child of God, we can help you to do that tonight if that's your desire. If you want to learn more about it, we can study with you. If you're already a child of God, but like Achan, you have sinned against God, and your future is in jeopardy, you have a moment tonight to go through the valley of Achor, to return to that dying to sin, to renew your commitment to dying with Jesus Christ, so that you can be with God in God's place. That's the door of hope that God has opened for all of us. If you're subject to the gospel invitation, then won't you come as we stand and sing this song?